Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay. And welcome to the last of these episodes to be recorded for a while from the benefit of isolation booths, because our spring travels at Unfrozen are about to begin. Dan's off to Europe first, to the Nordics, and then we'll reconvene in Venice for the preview of the Venice Architecture Biennale, where we'll have some live field recordings with various personages who will be there. But first, Dan, who's our guest this week?
Today we have Jeffrey Johnson. He is the head of the architecture school at the University of Kentucky and a principal of slab architecture. He is the author of China Lab, A Guide to Megablock Urbanism. This is actually a compendium project that started when he was at Columbia University a few years ago. And it's quite a tome. We're pretty excited to get into it. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
So the idea of the megablock is something that I would say probably originated in the 1960s with the metabolists and some of the superstructures that were happening back then. But it's a very much a ground-based reality in China. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how you would define a megablock or how you define a superblock and what got you interested in pursuing this topic.
Yeah, it's and maybe I'll start with the second part of that first, because the megablock is the predominant kind of form of urbanism in China. And I started research in China, you know, probably now 15, 16, 17 years ago. And what I noticed, what students noticed at the time, and then researchers and my co-researchers at the time, was the predominance of this large-scale development occurring in China, and that for us it was something that was at the scale of both sort of architecture in the city, and I was teaching in the architecture department and teaching predominantly architecture students. So it was kind of at that really interesting scale, somewhere between, you know, as I said, architecture in the city, but in many ways detrimental to both scales in some ways. And so what I thought and what we thought kind of as researchers is that the mega block would be a kind of perfect, or the super block would be a kind of perfect entry point for us into understanding cities in China. And something for us as a kind of research unit to be our kind of first research project, to kind of really unravel the kind of history of the super block or the mega block within China, but also, you know, internationally. And all the sort of forces that were creating the environment for the proliferation of these large-scale projects in China. So it really was, you know, based as that you know, our initiation into that was kind of like, oh, this seems like the perfect way in to kind of understand the city in China, in a contemporary, let's say the contemporary city in China. And we looked with the research both back and forward with our research. And I would say the kind of definition of that, I wouldn't say there's a kind of clear and distinct definition, but the way we looked at it is that it needed to be defined and bound, you know, by kind of both physical kind of boundaries, but also kind of social boundaries that kind of created a kind of development or housing, you know, project. It wasn't really based on, let's say, scale, even though, you know, we call it the sort of the mega block, you know, because most actually are quite large in scale. But we didn't really define it in terms of a kind of quantifiable scale. It had to do more with, let's say, a single site that was you know, multiple populations, et cetera, existing in a sort of self-sufficient way, let's say, right? So, which was also really fascinating. But that's the kind of how we defined it. And in more contemporary examples, it became clearer and clearer because it's a single architect or a single developer or someone that's building a larger scale kind of project. So we were kind of broad and diverse in what we defined in our research because we were just interested to see the different forms and iterations that they each took. but it had to be kind of unified in one of the many kind of categories that we used for that.
So you mentioned there was no defining characteristic that basically there wasn't a minimum criteria for how big a mega block would be, but you actually did go to quite a length to quantify each of the developments that you did study. You looked at density, you looked at green coverage, you looked at pricing, and I guess I would be very curious in what did you see in the extremes, and what do you take from the median of all of these projects?
Yeah, I mean, and again, they varied significantly, and you could see if you look through the data that we collected that they are from mostly large to extra large in their size, and the let's say economic base also varied from historical models, which are more like social housing, all the way up to luxury forms, luxury housing, right, to very contemporary projects themselves. And, you know, what things that we did find that were, let's say, common was that they did, and it is, I would say this was across all of them, in some ways defined themselves, as I said, as a kind of unified development or unified project or unified, in some senses protected, right, kind of urban unit, right, and in many cases that, you know, whether it's guards in a gate or a wall in a gate that's unguarded or an archway or a gateway that doesn't have a barrier, but there is a kind of, again, defining marker of a boundary into this. Also, you know, what we found in all of the projects, you know, was also like a kind of internalized organization. So they are very introverted, very introspective, very, let's say, internal to the way that it organizes itself as a kind of microcosm, you know, of a city. And that's what we really found interesting in some of the models. Now, not all of them were polyfunctional or had multiple functions or were mixed use. Many of them were monofunctional, strictly, you know, residential. So that whole idea that, you know, these were kind of microcosms of a city, we looked at those as kind of more positive examples. In that sense, where they were like more mixed use or had many, or even if they were not planned or designed in that manner, were adapted over time to include commercial spaces and things like that and the inside of these developments. So those are some of the things that, you know, for us were really interesting. We also kind of, you know, marked out, again, as we were seeking out not only a kind of critical path in understanding these projects, but also what we could glean from them as positive characteristics, right? If we are thinking about the project was about what we can learn from it, what we can learn from this form to create a more positive, you know, urban condition in the future. Certainly, we look at areas around the world where the reps continue to rapidly urbanize. You know, so that, you know, we were also seeking, you know, those kind of models that actually performed in unique ways, right? So those exceptions, whether it's in size and scale or then the way that they adapted themselves over time to create more community or let's say provide more of the community needs within the confines of that kind of enclave, right, in that. So, you know, and there are other characteristics that have a lot to do with that I would say are like the medium of that, have a lot to do with actual zoning, you know, and also building codes in China, which a lot have to do with FAR and or light and air, you know, the requirements for light and air into units. And we also see in Hong Kong, which even have more unique kind of requirements for light and air. But those conditions also created a kind of formula, right, for the development. And what we saw really interesting, and when we really pull apart one of those super blocks that's sitting in China, I mean, in Shanghai, you know, in the book as the kind of common, the typical super block, it really is a kind of formula of different types of units and different types of buildings. And you just basically lay them out as per the formula, as per code, and you extrude these blocks up to an FAR, and that works for light and air. And that's your, and then you sprinkle in the other amenities and other things, a kindergarten, you know, or a post office, or a commercial, a little supermarket or something in there. And that's the kind of baseline, right? That's the kind of norm or the typical form of the kind of super block within China. So that kind of model that we used in the book as the kind of typical super block, I would say, is we chose it based on what we found across the board as being the very common denominators of what a kind of the typical super block in China would be. And it had a wall around the compound, you know, with the kind of gates, so controlled entry points, an internal organization, etc.
Well, I've lived in China for 2 years, from 15 to 17, and spent a good deal of time studying some of these blocks myself. And I noticed that you had a couple of atypical blocks in here where someone tried to sort of break the mold, particularly the work of Stephen Hull in places like Chengdu with porosity block and then linked hybrid in Beijing. And it's funny that he uses words like porosity because, you know, what we discovered between the time that the design had been created and our visit, which is, I think actually we came back in 2019 to linked hybrid, was that a fence had been built around it after it was constructed, even though the whole point of it was to be more open to the community. You know, it was a facility that had a cinema that you could come in and from ostensibly outside the community and see movies. You know, some landscape parks, and of course the sky bridges connecting the buildings was a subject of, you know, interest for us. I guess the question was, you know, for those that did break with the formula, did you see better renting rates for those, or were they not as successful, or did they become more successful after they were sort of tamed back into the, you know, the mold of the typical super block?
Well, that the case that you're speaking of, you know, with the linked hybrid with Stephen Hull, I mean, the developer, I mean, that was the basic claim of the developer that that they, or the managing agency, was not able to get the rents that they had imagined with the linked hybrid, and one of those reasons was that it did not have a wall around it, right? It did not have that kind of typical sort of architectural control or that boundary that would, in many ways, in this case, it's a little bit more exclusive kind of housing. So in a way, it creates a more exclusive environment, or at least that was the perception, right, of the managing agency and the developer. And so, I mean, so their basic claim, because Stephen Hull basically refused to design the wall, and that is why the wall itself looks like it's from centuries ago, and it's not a contemporary example of a wall or anything you'd imagine that Stephen Hull would design for his project. But they claimed that, yeah, absolutely, they put the wall in, they added guards on the grounds to, you know, at least to what would be perceived by the people living there, that they're having more control of the public, even though there's all those public programs on the interior. Now, you can still enter, you can walk in those spaces, but you do feel, I mean, in a guard, you know, a guard will, if you were there, I would take architecture students there all the time, or Steve, you know, and oftentimes if you are just lingering around taking photographs of the architecture, you'll be asked to leave if you're not you know, visiting one of the commercial spaces there. And they did claim, yes, they were able to get you know, higher rates for the property. And we see that in that case, I mean, that's why that's a really interesting case. There are other cases where that has not happened. Soho, also in China, now their developer has many projects, but Jinhui, original project. And I would say kind of an original open block, a porous block that is a kind of super block, was successful. Now, those units are both live and live work, and that was their kind of model. Now, they have, again, an open block without a perimeter wall, very successful, very active, a lot of commercial programs in multiple layers, not just even the ground floor, so multiple layers. It's worked. However, most people rent those spaces for offices and not for residential. So what they saw in that model was that actually it works commercially as a commercial office of commercial office space more than it does as residential or live work. There are some live work and some people that still dwell in this project. But so what worked better was them to be commercial, at least in the research that we were doing, or the mixed use. So commercial blocks did prove to be more successful with the open blocks than the residential, you know, in that sense, at least the examples that we were looking at, or in conversations with the developers. You know, that's what they noticed, that many of the, at least those that are, you know, less like the expats and others that may be more willing to live in open blocks, they certainly found from the Chinese population the popularity of a kind of walled, controlled, enclave living or exclusive living environment was more desired, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it might be, for the uninitiated, it might seem as if this is an entirely new recent development, and certainly the scale of it is, you know, the absolute repetitiveness and the speed with which these have been constructed, you know, since the age of opening up under Deng Xiaoping, you know, began. But, you know, if you go look at traditional neighborhoods in Chinese cities, a lot of times those are gated too. And they're actually, you know, they're not gated in the same kind of way, but generally speaking, they have gates around them and they have a sort of interiority to them. And there are generally only a few points at which you can exit to the surrounding blocks. And it just is a sort of way of reinforcing that it's a community. So it has a less ominous kind of feel to it, but you still have to sort of walk past a guy who's usually there drinking tea and petting a stray cat or whatever. But, you know, they don't give you a whole lot of trouble in those more traditional neighborhoods. But I guess the question is, you know, this seems to be something that the market's very comfortable with in China. And is it wrong to sort of impose our westernized idea of open porosity on the Chinese and just, you know, to just let them have it?
No, and you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, for us as a research project, that was one of the things that we had to really, let's say, alter the way in which we were viewing this kind of form of a kind of urbanism, and exactly because of that reason. And what we found is exactly what you're pointing out, is a kind of legacy, right, of these kind of controlled spaces, or the idea of the hutongs, you know, the hutong neighborhoods in Beijing, which were, you know, long alleys, which are essentially long walls, and you have kind of layers of spaces, you know, from the most public to the most private, into the courtyard structures, right? So the basic unit there, these kind of nested spaces behind the walls, and the courtyard as the kind of basic organizer of those residential dwelling. And the traditional city in China also, in its gridded form, and again, we're talking about millennia, right, this kind of basic model of urban planning, was also formed around kind of large-scale blocks, right, and their control points. And at times, historically, even in the hutongs or the alleyways, right, that either end of that, and that's a pretty long distance, right, that you walk through it through an alley, there used to also be control points, or could at any time be controlled by guards when there's curfews and other things like that. So again, we see these large-scale blocks. And again, you look at any traditional Chinese city, you're going to see these large blocks. And so already with the organization, again, a traditional organization, they were creating a kind of very introspective way of dwelling within the city, controlled by a grid, controlled by a block, controlled also through layers of walls and thresholds, et cetera. So you're absolutely right. And so for us too, it was really important to kind of shed or forget for a while those kind of conventions that we're bringing forward, to at least assume one is better, right? And try to get to exactly what, why, right? That the kind of exclusivity or these walled communities were more desirable than an open block, right? Without so absolutely to that point, one of the issues I would say is that where we remained somewhat still critical in the way that we looked at some of the projects is just again at the scale and length of those walls and what that actually does to the urban fabric, right? As you were saying, like you can walk down a hutong or a lulong in Shanghai or other traditional forms, and there is activity, even though that may just be a wall and doorways, right? There is an extension of that dwelling space on the street, and there is activity in that street. What some of these contemporary large-scale developments now in China, it could be an eighth of a mile. It could be a quarter of a mile, it seems, you're walking down the street, and all you're walking along is a wall. Right. And so if one imagines an urbanism which just perpetuates that at that scale, what does that do? How does that change the street, the notion of the pedestrian and those kind of things within China? So, it's an interesting balance. Or how do you rethink the notion of the wall architecturally? Right. And I think we saw in some cases, you could even see in some of those traditional neighborhoods and the perimeter of those large-scale blocks in Beijing that kind of wrap around the hutongs, neighborhoods, that there has over time been a kind of commercialization of the street that's essentially building itself out or adapting what was, in some many cases, a wall at one point, or at least a pretty opaque condition where they build those out, and now the wall becomes a thickened kind of commercial space, right? Formalized and informal, the way they do that. So those became really interesting learning moments, right? That the wall and the way that one encloses a large scale space can be adaptable and can actually be transformed in something very active. Let's say if we're saying that the sort of activity on the street is something to maintain, right, in some ways cherish, right, as we think about the city of the future.
Interesting. I want to ask, about the effects of the pandemic. And I'm curious, like, how that factors into the book or in post that. Because obviously, we saw waves of lockdowns. I recently wrote a oral history for Rafi Siegel and Marissa Morignon's book, Design and Solidarity, about how residents of the megablocks become basically used, various messaging apps, and were forming these ad hoc communities limited to their buildings because of that. And so I'm curious, what did you observe in terms of the social rituals, I guess, of inhabitants before then, both before and after the pandemic, when suddenly these truly became isolated structures, worlds unto their own because of the Wuhan and Shanghai lockdowns?
Yeah. Now, I would just say this was all written and conducted before COVID, actually quite a bit before COVID. So, but there's no really research in that, in the book or that I've actually conducted since COVID or during COVID. However, what you are saying, some of that we did look at in our research, some of the social structures that make up the sort of super block, right? And again, those are in many ways some of the positive things that we learned about that kind of, as we said, the kind of community building within the block, right? And having many of the amenities for your kind of daily needs provided within that, and what kind of social structure that creates within the kind of super block, right? And what kind of apps and devices are used within that, within the block. So again, this is would be all speculation. I can only imagine that absolutely within those moments of lockdown and the varying scales of these blocks, if the control points were probably for many the exterior boundary of those blocks, right? Now, whether they, and I don't know in every case whether the building, I know there are curfews and there are reasons to remain inside, But when some of those were certainly relieved or you're able to go outside, that block actually is going to provide, as it does normally for many of the people, their kind of daily social, their social structure. It provides places for their recreation, and contemplation and things like that are all within the confines. So all I can say is I imagine that they were very much in so many cases actually beneficial, right, in this kind of condition. Or one can imagine, hopefully we don't have to experience something like this again. But the way that, again, if we're projective in a way where the positives for some of these projects could provide in positive areas in the future of thinking about cities, absolutely, like that. What is that kind of internalized, what are the internalized benefits of that community building within that, the kind of, again, it's no different than a neighborhood, right? It's essentially a neighborhood, but it's just bound and defined through a kind of urban, an architectural context, right? Whether it's a street or it's a wall or whatever it might be in that way. So they're all bound by that. Because it's just larger. Like if we use New York City as an example, Chicago or anything, the blocks are just so much larger, right? So much bigger. And where we have a little bit, the way we would generally, define neighborhoods, in the United States, or through social, familiarity, similarity, solidarity, things like that, but they're not necessarily always bound by physical things, right? And obviously, in some cases there are, if they're a park or a river or something, or a large scale infrastructure can certainly define neighborhoods. But this is almost like it is clear what the definition of that neighborhood is in a super block, right? It is bound. And you are inside, you are not outside, and those that are outside are not part of the inside. In that way. So I am sure, again, these the super block as a community forming device actually is quite powerful and has a lot of potential.
One of the things that it kind of occurs to me, if you ever look at a, a street map or the street grid of a Chinese city next to an American city, one of the things that you will notice is the relative scale of these super blocks. It's almost like you've been dropping, buildings that would have been on a 200 square, 200 by 200 foot block in New York City onto a grid that's like a suburban size grid in America. That's almost what a super block is, right? Because if you think about the way that your suburban neighborhoods are designed, let's say in Chicago where I am, you've got the 36 miles square grid townships, and then within that you have the 1 mile square grid, and then within that you have all your little wormy suburban streets, and there's only a few points of access to the main arteries. Difference being, of course, is that the population density is so much less, so you absolutely have to drive around to get to anything. If you live 500 feet from the main road, you might have to drive 3/4 of a mile to get to it. So I guess my question would be, did you notice variations in these developments that were very auto-centric versus, transit-oriented, and did they have different scales as a result? And did you find one to be more successful or popular than the other?
One of the, without a doubt, certainly if we look at, let's say, middle income t towards like luxury housing, right? That providing the opportunity to have an automobile is very, very important in many of those models. And I would say that the higher end, more expensive housing would, certainly in a dense urban area would, in some cases, could provide parking, built in, or underground parking structures and things like that. And that in many ways is also which helps make the kind of gated community or kind of enclave popular for many that what one could say even moves out to the periphery of the large cities in China is the fact to be able to have a automobile, to have a car. Because if you can imagine in the Hutongs in Beijing, if we use that as an example, even if you were to renovate a courtyard structure there for a personal use as a residence, you don't have a place to park a car. And there's nowhere nearby to park the car, at least legally. And it's very difficult to get a car in and out of the Hutongs, and they're like kind of informally one way, you know, but it's not really, you know, in most cases adhered to, right? So there's lots of, you know, if you were in the middle of that block, and we're talking, this is, you know, almost a quarter of a mile, you know, or an eighth of a mile walking into the block, and there's a car, you know, or you drive in and you're, you know, you can't get back out sometimes. So in that, in the case where there is, again, a kind of desire, you know, for a sort of contemporary or modern way of living, the automobile plays a huge role in it. Now, as far as accessibility goes, I mean, absolutely, just depending on where the development is occurring. It, generally, it would be near, you know, main arteries that are linking to the center of the city. Also, it could, commuter rail lines, you know, are also very popular, and which we saw as a again, as the cities grew, you see them along commuter rail lines that all of a sudden these nodes are popping up of these super blocks around, you know, where they made decisions to put a kind of station, right, for that, which was rural land or industrial land before. In some of our case studies, you know, we kind of mapped and researched, you know, some of these areas of transformation in Shanghai that were developing around, again, these new extensions of these, again, commuter rail, you know. So, so absolutely, depending on, again, excuse me, your ability to afford that. Now, I would say those without the luxury of an automobile, or those without the luxury of you know, the economic luxury of living in a middle class to higher end super block, also can find themselves on the fringes or areas of city. And a lot of people who are being relocated from the center of cities for new development, for example, or for any development for, you know, the Olympics or World Expo or other things, find themselves in their new housing out, you know, in the the perimeter of the city, with little access to public transportation and without the means for automobile private ownership and things like that. So we definitely see that those that can afford have the luxuries of those things, all the way from, you know, a parking spot to access to public transportation, to those with less, who are oftentimes in many ways forced to live, you know, without that kind of connection, without that, the link to transport. Or if they have it, it could be a bus, but the bus is infrequent, et cetera. So that commute could be 4 and 5 times longer than those that have the automobile or have access to public transportation or train, for example. So in that case, for sure, I mean, it's the new contemporary developments in all cities that are of again, upper middle class or one can say luxury housing, a lot of them provide parking garages or underground parking, because that's really important. And they're of course going to be at the most desirable locations. Right. Yeah. So that's not a different model, right? I mean, the same way it's again, open market for housing in China. You know, it wasn't, you know, it was social housing up until just a few decades ago, you know, so now it's basically a free market for housing. So similar, it has to do with demand and desires and affordability, and, you know, those that can't are forced to move further and further away from the center of the city, but they're also living in, you know, super blocks, as are the wealthy.
Yeah, in that way, it is kind of equalizing from a typological standpoint, if not an amenities standpoint. Yeah, I guess a question would be, you know, this has been identified so far in this podcast as a specifically Chinese phenomenon, but one of the things that is, seems to be happening now is that, you know, the market for real estate in China is slowing down, and consequently, they're looking for new markets and places to export their technology and their methodology. And of course, Africa is one of those places. The book starts to get into that, but I imagine it's even more that way now. Have you looked into that at all? Like how does the super block differ in places where it has been exported as opposed to just extended within China?
Yeah, the now what we the case studies that we were looking at in Africa were very similar in the way of its the basic characteristics of the planning, right? And they were larger blocks, etc. However, they were at least in the examples that we saw, some of the before I said some of the cases where we saw the larger scale proposals that we've saw and architects would present, you know, that were present to us, some of their proposals for Africa were very, very similar. I mean, in the way that they're presented, the way that they are rendered, the way they are marketed, etc., are very similar in scale, and I would say in sort of architectural attitude, you know, towards it as a kind of marketing device for living abroad, or and in many cases, it is a marketing for moving Chinese citizens to work in Africa or to South America or to other places, as much as it is for improvements in those countries and also for real estate opportunities there for whomever, right? But what we see in some of the Africa examples are the large scale blocks, but not so much, not always with the kind of controlled walled compound. Always. So the kind of planning scale is similar, but the density is also not quite as extreme. But it's not necessarily in all cases a kind of physically defined enclave with a wall or in gates. And some are, some certainly are, and those are going to be the more exclusive ones. But in some cases, we just see like little extruded blocks being built up on the large scale block. So let's say less definition by physical barriers or boundaries than let's say the typical super block. So that we've seen. I mean, and again, I think where we see you know, it's sort of the other again the more commercialized spectrum of these super blocks, or where we've seen them in higher end financial developments or urban developments, are definitely the mixed use projects or transit-oriented development projects, you know, which we see in the United States, we see other places, which Hong Kong is absolutely, you know, where we see some of those examples on the extreme, where we see those kind of models, depending again on the financial situation, right, and the economics of the location of what is affordable or sustainable, right? But we do see that as a kind of model that's a little bit, again, borrowed. I mean, in a way, China borrowed some of those models from Hong Kong. Hong Kong borrowed, I mean, you know, mixed use and transit-oriented development isn't didn't it wasn't invented in Hong Kong, but they probably in many ways perfected a lot of those ideas because of the density and the but also just the idea that there's the, you know, public transportation, mass transportation, is so effective there. So I think, you know, those are the models that probably, even though we haven't seen them in the more remote exportation, you know, in the areas of kind of exporting the kind of super block or mega block, in some of the extreme locations for that, that is probably a model that will definitely be expanded on and developed, again, and continue to develop. Again, it's across the world we have those types, but Hong Kong and some places in China, it's even to a more extreme, and those are definitely going to be models which kind of operate also in a kind of the global economic, you know, the kind of flow of global economics, right? More so probably than the smaller scale urban models that we see in some of the more remote areas in Africa or South America or Brazil.
Well, expanding on that a bit, have you seen any signs of how the model's been sort of smuggled back into the global north in various forms? Like, I've always been intrigued by the fact, for example, that like KPF in particular, you know, building its various 66 projects and Roppongi Hills before that. I mean, I once alarmed Bill Peterson by suggesting that Hudson Yards was effectively Songdo or 66 on the Hudson. The client would not want to hear that, but it seems like some of these models have snuck their way in.
Yeah, for sure. And again, that's what I say. Like, it's not, it kind of, that model exists. I mean, we've seen the super block, again, it has historically, I mean, through modernism anyway, right? We've seen various types of super block development. I mean, Lincoln Center is a kind of form of a super block. It's not so, let's say, commercialized. It's cultural, right? But it basically similarly used, you know, urban renewal as a form of tearing down, you know, number of blocks of housing, right, or urban fabric in New York City to build a kind of cultural super block, right? Has all the same controls. It's open and porous, but there are so many kind of methods and mechanisms that make it more exclusive, right? Elite, and it leaves its, you know, elevates itself from the sidewalk, et cetera, up to a kind of platform and all kinds of things. But it's interesting that it's kind of like the transformation of those and the opportunities that one sees. And that's why I say, like, absolutely Hudson Yards is exactly a perfect example. But I don't know what exactly you could point to in Hong Kong or in Shenzhen or Chengdu or these places that says, oh, that's definitely was something that was formulated in China first and then brought to, let's say, United States, because it's a kind of economic model is and development model as much as it is an urban model, right, or an architectural model that we do see, you know, historically in places around the world, right? You need abundancy in land, right, to actually create something of this scale. So you also have to have the mechanisms in place to be able to do something at that scale. Either you need to have the resources in the land available or the scale, or you have to have either a developer with the means to do it, or in the forms that we had historically in America, eminent domain and other you know, controversial methods of creating from smaller scale blocks to large scale, right? And you know, that's the other thing. What are those mechanisms in the United States or New York? You know, they're infrastructural sites, right? That kind of remain undeveloped. And we saw it, you know, also in Brooklyn, you know, so around Barclays. And so, you know, we did, and it doesn't really find its way in the book because I would say it was inconclusive, but we did some work. So like went to Flushing, you know, in New York City, because of the large population of you know, Chinese in Flushing, and just wondered, like, in new projects, in new developments, because we started to see, you know, actually Chinese and Hong Kongese developers, right, investing in, now there are more, but let's say 15 years ago, we were starting to see now money invested in New York City from Chinese companies, and what were they building and what were they developing, right? And we did see similarities in larger scale housing and things like that, but I can't say necessarily that it was a direct correlation to say, oh, that's exactly one of these, you know, super blocks we see in China transported into to Flushing. But we definitely saw the interest of that, of linking the finances and the development and the investment in companies in China doing super block development now, you know, in Flushing and other places in the United States, you know, so that's, we started to trace some of that. Right. But I can't say there was a direct, exactly like in some of the cases in Africa and others, that it's a direct, you know, copy, right. That it is definitely a complete copy of a kind of urban plan, right. Onto again, you need an open area, right, and or a kind of clearing of a site somewhere to develop something from scratch, like at that scale. But anyway, it's a super interesting question. I would just say that's still, for my interest in things too, it's still an open one and really interesting to see how this continues to mutate and transform as a type, and where it succeeds and where it doesn't, or where it can't, or where it shouldn't, you know, or where it should, right? In many ways, as a kind of urban, or as an urban model.
Well, you mentioned Flushing. I was actually there about a month ago, and I have never been anywhere in the United States more authentically Chinese. I mean, in every aspect, and it's almost like a 1 to 0.25 scale model of a super block in the Chinese city. You know, it's like it fits into the New York grid, but it's everything is organized that way. You know, with the restaurants being on the first floor, second floor, third floor, stacked. You know, it smells the same. You know, the rains feels the same. It's like, I was like, I can see why people find it so comfortable to land there if they're moving from China. But I guess the question I would have is, you know, it seems like you've taken a very even-handed look at these developments. You know, you're not necessarily saying they're all bad, not necessarily saying they're all good. They just are, and it's the way that a lot of people live in a good portion of China and in the Chinese diaspora, as it turns out. Do you feel like they can be authentic places just like any other type of neighborhood or any other type of building typology? Or are there inhibitors to that? Like what do you think is, how are these going to look in, I don't know, 30 years? Are they going to look grown in? Or are they going to look like, are they going to be endearing like older neighborhoods in cities?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I think in some cases, what we were able to learn from older superblocks, and I say older, that might be 50s or 60s, right? They were sort of social housing, was with the demands of providing, you know, accommodations and dwelling for growing urban populations in some cases. Some of these early social super blocks were adapted and transformed internally with additional kind of structures, almost makes do-it-yourself structures and all kinds. So what used to be those central spaces, in many cases open spaces or green spaces, etc., were kind of transformed, or large, small scale. So, like accessory buildings and things like that were transformed, right, into multiple sort of do-it-yourself almost housing models, right? And so in some cases, those where they could be adapted, you know, internally, there was a kind of an ability or an allowance to them to transform them, right, on the inside, what's happening on the inside. And that was kind of interesting, right? And that is, like, again, a question of when one thinks about this as a model for a future, is like, what are the elements that remain kind of fixed and what's adaptable, you know, over time, or what's transformable? I mean, obviously, knocking a wall down is not, you know, doesn't require a huge effort, right? In the case that if there were to be more desire to connect urbanistically some of these sites, you know, or connect them more traditionally, I'd say traditionally, to a street, right? In a sense, you know, so you know, that the way that it grows in, I think it will grow from the inside out, right? I don't think the pressures from the city, from the outside, at least from what we were seeing, because and I am totally generalizing, you know, in a sense of the, you know, municipal planners, etc., but in many cases are very content in having developers and private funds build large chunks of the city, right, for the city. And if you can imagine, the larger that block is, the larger they're handing off to a private enterprise or a developer to develop. Cities like, well, it's not, we don't have to build the infrastructure inside that. We're not building small scale blocks. We're not having to maintain any of that, right? So I think, you know, the way that one functions and adapts over time and the ability to transform it is going to, again, I think it's going to be so motivated by the inhabitants within and what those changing needs might be. And I would say, like, the more adaptable that one plans for within any of these, the more likely that they can adapt and evolve, right, with new needs and new things over time. I'm not so convinced that they will evolve from anything external, saying let's control the way that we are, or let's be, you know, more conscientious about the future of the urban environment from the outside of these kind of conditions. And so in that case, I don't know. And that's kind of one of the, what I would say, the critical questions that we have from the research is like, if this were to persist and roll itself out in the most ideal form of what the super block or mega block is, what does the city of the future look like, right? And if everyone is contained within a kind of self-contained enclave, it already is in China. It's already radically changing that, right? And it's radically changing it at a huge scale. So, you know, the notion of Main Street, like, does not exist, right? And that's the way we look at the kind of condition in China. It's not. And the notion of the pedestrian experience in the city is just much different, right? And all that. So what is that in the future? You know, or how is it linked to mass transit and everything else? So kind of nodal development, right? I mean, we're talking with the huge expansion of infrastructure and investment in China, you know, where and the ability to expand, you know, and extend the populations further and further outward along these infrastructural networks are going to, you know, radically change the way the landscape and the way the kind of urban and rural relationships exist, and what that means as these little enclaves of development that'll just be, you know, basically deployed across the sort of, you know, rural landscape of China, all connected through infrastructure, and you know, so like the settling in or whatever that might be as these evolve within an urban environment, I mean, have a huge consequence, you know, certainly for what is urban life, you know, in the future. But if it's all internalized, then perhaps, you know, it is a kind of completely internalized kind of experience, right? That you are basically living in your neighborhood, right? And your neighborhood is providing you, you know, I was living in Park Slope before moving, you know, everything is there within blocks away. It just happens to have a wall around it, right, in a certain way. And there is some accessibility. It's not completely exclusive, but you may have to get buzzed in. You may have to, you know, go through a gate. I don't know. But it could still function. And that's why I say the change is in all that's going to be internal. It's not, I don't feel it to be external forces probably won't change it. Right. I think it will be from the inside, the way that it changes in wanting a desire to be more connected, perhaps, to other parts of the city, you know, that might change it from the inside or through change of desire a little bit. But we'll see. It's an interesting question, you know, what that looks like, you know, and, you know, there are huge questions that we can already, if we imagine the city in the future, you know, what is the notion of, you know, preservation within a culture that recycles so quickly or is already through, you know, quick cycles of, you know, building and then demolition and reconstruction or rebuilding that are, you know, only it could happen in years and not even decades sometimes, right? That these buildings, they're completely replaced with new models, with new ones. So it's, yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know, but it would be certainly interesting to trace those, you know, even past my development or in my research of what happens, you know, in the future. I mean, it's hard to, you know, I mean, you know, there certainly could be policy that changes that could radically change the way that most development happens. And that has to do with the, you know, one ownership and control of the land, right? And the government controls the land and controls the policy. And right now, for the most part, they are auctioning off large chunks of the city to single developers, right? And they're figuring out ways to control a large piece And so things won't be radically different until certain things like that may change, you know. And I think one of the models in the book, Yong Ho Cheng, you know, he brought the kind of small block to Jiading, which is just outside of Shanghai, and he was asked to do a large scale block development, and he's, you know, he countered that, right? And his radical proposal was, you know what, I'm going to do small little blocks and little buildings and little blocks for this development. You know, and that's, you know, if you look at that, the drawings in the book, you look at the scheme, you might not think that that's a very radical urban planning model, but for China, it absolutely is, right? Because they're just, it's not the typical way of thinking about taking a large chunk of a city and making little streets and roads through it. You know, it's like start by putting a wall around it, you know, and then a couple of access points, and then organize it all from the inside. So it, I mean, it could change, but like it, just notions of preservation, you know, like what will, and I think goes to your point, like where has value, right? And what will be preserved? And I think, you know, that will be designed, the market, and it will certainly just determine that, and individual desires and things will change. And I think that will come from inside. I think inside the block, you know, will be the biggest influence, I think, of how the actual block changes.
So from within the imposed grid, a thousand flowers will bloom organically, we can conclude. Jeffrey Johnson, thank you very much. China Lab Guide to Megablock Urbanism. This has been an episode of Unfrozen.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure to talk about it. Yep.
Bye-bye.
If you don't know what's going on behind his disguise, nobody knows where Buster goes. You steal your woman out from under your nose. Does anyone know the way? Do we hear someone say?
We just haven't got a clue what to do.
Does anyone know the way? There's got to be a way.
To Buster!
The cops are out. They're running about. Don't know if they'll ever be able to block Buster out. He's gotta be caught. He's gotta be taught. 'Cause he is more evil than